The Tom Woods Show, episode 2237.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you old timers out there from the Ron Paul 2008 campaign, you may remember my friend Larry Lepard, who spent $200,000 of his own money on full-page newspaper ads in support of Dr. Paul. Well, Larry has had an uncanny way with money over the years, and he made a presentation to my paid membership on how to insure yourself against currency debasement, that is to say, how to survive inflation. Well, I took that presentation out from behind the paywall, and I'm making it available to the general public for free. Check it out at tomwoods.com/Larry. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am delighted to be joined once again by our old friend Dominic Frisby.
Hello, Tom.
Dom, I am just at a loss when I try to describe what you do. You know, it's easy. If somebody's a professor at such and such college, I just say that and I'm done with it. But you do so many things, I don't know what to tell people.
Yeah,
so you want to take a crack at it?
I'm not really sure what I do either. My eldest daughter's 20 and she's going through that thing where I think a lot of people at that age go through for many years in some cases where they don't know what they want to do with their life. And so they have a sort of, they know they're good at some things and not so good at others, and they don't really know what they want to do, and they have a sort of mini crisis. And I try and say to her, look, I'm 53 and I still don't know what I want to do. But I've got a sort of mixed background where I always wanted to be a writer, and I looked at the best writers in history, Shakespeare and Dickens and Chaucer and various Greeks and so on, and I noticed that one thing they all had in common is that they'd started out as actors. And so I figured to become a good writer, I should start out as an actor. So I went to drama school. Then I ended up being the best at radio in drama school for no apparent reason. So I got a voiceover agent. So I found myself for many years doing voiceovers. And then I wrote this comic song, and I had a friend who was a music agent. I said to him, can I release this as a novelty single? And he said, go and do it in my brother's comedy club. So I went and did it in his brother's comedy club, did an open spot, and the gig went very well, and they gave me a paid booking. And so suddenly I found myself as a stand-up comedian. And then that sort of went from there. And then I'd made a bit of money, and I was working out how to invest it. We're in the noughties now. And I started reading about gold. And so I started there were all these clever people talking about gold and money. So I started a podcast as a means to introduce them. And you know what it's like doing a podcast. A, you build up relationships with people really quickly. An interview is a sort of heightened form of, an exaggerated form of spending half an hour with somebody or an hour or however long the interview is. And the second thing is that happens, you find yourself learning loads. And one of the people I interviewed said, oh, do you want to come and write for our magazine? And it was called Money Week. And I said, I don't really know what I'm talking about. And she said, that doesn't matter. And suddenly I found myself with a financial column. And from there, I wrote a very successful film, documentary about the financial crisis and various books. And so I've got this weird life as financial writer and comedian. So that's how it happened.
When you talked about your daughter, I thought you were going to be referring to the problem my daughters have, which is trying to explain to people what their father does for a living, because that's another problem. Forget about what they want to do. They can't figure out what I do at this point, because it's so many things and such odd things. And you certainly don't want to say, my father is a podcast host. I mean, you may as well say he's an unemployed bum. You know, you don't want to necessarily tell them that.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about the word podcast. I don't like the word podcast. It sort of...
It sounds so unserious.
Yeah. If you said broadcaster or something, then it sounds much more grandiose and significant. But podcast, it just sort of sounds too small. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, look, we can lament our career choices all we like, but let's focus on what's going on over there. Now, I will grant that the topic we're discussing today, which is kind of just more or less what's going on over in the UK, is a little bit delayed. And that's mainly because, although I do know other people over there whose judgment I trust, I could have had on to talk. Do you know Toby Baxendale, by any chance?
I do, very well, actually.
Okay, so I mean, so he's an example.
I'm on a WhatsApp chat group with him.
Oh, good, okay. But you were out of town, and I thought, you're my pick for this. So we waited. So, okay, so it's a little bit out of the news cycle, but that's okay. I want these episodes to be evergreen anyway. So I want to talk about what the heck went on over there over the past month or so. And in particular, I'll say that a few months ago, I was in Scotland and I happened to visit, he doesn't live in Scotland, but I visited somebody, let's just say, that I feel certain that both of us know. And he told me that of the plausible choices, Liz Truss at least had some decent instincts, even if she wasn't particularly energetic or charismatic. She had some decent instincts. And so of the plausible choices, he was cautiously optimistic. And it didn't quite turn out that way. What was your impression of her even before her brief tenure ended?
Well, I'm biased because Liz Truss wrote a very nice review of one of my books. So
that does it to me too.
But I like Liz Truss. I write comic songs, as you know, and she likes them, and she always used to send me nice messages about them and stuff. And she got elected fair and square. You know, she followed all the procedures. She was brilliant as our trade secretary, going around the world signing trade deals with everyone. And she was elected fair and square within the rules of what goes on with the, not by the electorate, but by within the rules of what goes on with the Conservative Party. She won the popular vote of the membership. And then she was prime minister, and she gambled everything that we were going to grow our way out of this economic mess. And then she did this terrible, terrible thing, which was to announce a budget that surprised everyone because it lowered taxes. And I saw that budget and I was like, this is fantastic. And it just came out of nowhere. And the problem was for her, and where they got her, was that she also, at the same time as lowering taxes, didn't lower spending. So there was quite easy to make the case. In fact, she increased spending because there was all this bailout money to do with fuel bills. And so it was quite easy to make the case that she wasn't funding her expenditure. Never mind the fact that every government since about 50 years in our country hasn't funded its expenditure once. She just did it by a bit much. But it provoked this ire in her enemies. How dare she slash taxes? She's only benefiting the rich, all this kind of thing. You know how the left can't distinguish between income and capital. And she slashed income tax by 5%, and everyone thought that was benefiting the rich. Never mind the fact that most of the rich don't pay income tax because they make their money from their growth in the appreciation of their assets, their companies and houses and so on. In any case, they absolutely went for her. And what they got her on is that as her Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng was announcing the budget that slashed all the taxes, earlier that week, the Bank of England announced to the market that it was going to do quantitative tightening. In other words, it was going to start selling all the gilts, which is our word for treasuries, that it had bought. So it was a bit like in 1999 when the Bank of England announced it was going to sell all our gold, and it announced it to the market beforehand. So everyone was like, okay, well, I'm not buying any gold, and the gold price cratered. Well, the same thing happened with the gilt market, and the gilts interest rate spiked and the value of gilts collapsed. Now, the Bank of England announced this, and the sell-off in gilts began the day before Kwarteng's announcement. But then Kwarteng made his budget, and everyone blamed Kwarteng and the budget for the collapsing gilts. Never mind, it was totally caused by the Bank of England. And this has been incredibly underreported. Everyone jumped on Truss. She was totally unprepared for the ideological onslaught, where she would be attacked by the left and by people within her own party who resented the fact that she'd won the leadership. The Conservative Party is incredibly divided. So they put her under this incredible pressure. She didn't have the strength of mind that, say, Thatcher had to fall back on core principles. And she just U-turned, like, within a few days. And then as soon as she U-turned, you knew it was game over, because you knew she didn't have the backbone. And she's got a bit of a history of U-turning. You know, she started out as a Lib Dem and then she became a sort of Brexiteer, but she actually voted Remain. So to sum up, she tried to do the right thing and the markets wouldn't let her and everyone jumped on her. And poor thing, eventually she had to go. But the tragedy of it all for our country is now, for 10 or 20 years, the idea of lowering income tax is now politically toxic. And that is awful.
It's unbelievable how demoralizing politics just is right now everywhere in the world, it seems to me. The news is just uniformly bad. The intentions of these people are, well, you know, what I keep saying is, in the old days, and by old days I mean 10 years ago, what we call progressives in the US, at least on the surface, claimed that they were trying to improve the standard of living of the average person. Now, everything they recommend would have the opposite effect, but at least they claimed, we're trying to make you better off. Now it's almost openly, we're going to be making you worse off. Let's just be honest. You're going to pay much higher fuel prices. You might not be able to afford a car. You know, food, you're going to have to just switch into eating different sorts of things. It's unbelievable how blunt they are about it. And even more unbelievable, how many people are clapping for this? Yes, yes, I want my standard of living undermined consistently. Well, I don't know what to say about it.
If you look at a lot of the sort of anti-oil, anti-fossil fuel campaigners and so on, they almost always have this hashtag that accompanies with them, end capitalism. And it's not fossil fuels that they object to per se, even though they're doing everything they can to stop the burning of them. It's actually progress. They want to stop capitalism. And I think people have just, because of all the miseducation that's gone on, people can't distinguish between proper capitalism, as you or I would define it, and crony capitalism. But nevertheless, they have this hashtag, end capitalism. Now, if you look at human beings, ever since the beginning of time, we have consumed energy. You know, the amount of energy that we consume, there's almost a direct correlation with progress of civilization. And as civilizations progress, they consume more energy. In many ways, my father's generation were more civilized than I am in that they were more courteous and more dignified and so on. But we are more advanced than my father's generation were. We consume more energy because, you know, we use computers and central heating and all the things that they didn't have when they were children. So we consume more energy. And so energy consumption is a sign of progress. And we wouldn't enjoy all the things that we enjoy, from computers to central heating to cars to planes to running water, and we wouldn't enjoy any of these things were it not for fossil fuels. And yet there is this movement to stop us using fossil fuels. And effectively, it wants to stop progress. Now, you look at great empires in the past, you know, for example, the Roman Empire, or a great example is the Islamic Empire. You know, from the sort of 7th century through to the 12th or 13th century, it was probably the most enlightened civilization on earth, or one of them. And it contributed huge amounts to human progress in mathematics and trade and goodness knows what else, and architecture. And then from maybe the 15th century or something, Islam went into this sort of repressive dark age, where in terms of human progress, it contributed very little. And now it's sort of in dribs and drabs coming out the other side. Now, is the West now, even culturally, we seem to be losing enlightenment, but are we, because of all these political movements and various things, are we going into our own dark age? Because if we're not very careful, we are.
You know, the thing is, everybody will say, everybody says they're living in a dark age. You know, you people who think the sky is falling, you're so predictable, you're always saying this is the worst possible time. Well, if you look back in history, other people said it was the worst possible time. But you know what? Maybe at that time it was. Maybe at this time it's worse. I mean, I don't consider that to be impossible. On the fuel thing, by the way, if I want to say a couple things related to while I was in Scotland, because we were in Edinburgh the whole time. But the trip was interesting politically, even though I didn't have any speaking engagements or anything. First, because of the vandalism and the graffiti that we would see, particularly at Barclays, because people would vandalize it for being involved in, I guess, financing fossil fuels and that industry. And so I wanted to go out under cover of night and respond to the vandalism with my own spray paint can. And I was saying to my wife, look, this would be great because maybe the vandal will then come back and answer me and we'll get a whole colloquy going.
Then
I thought, yeah, yes, exactly. That's right. That's right. But then I thought, you know, I don't really know what the laws say about this this country, and I don't want to have to be bailed out by the U.S. embassy because they'll take one look at my Twitter feed and they'll say, no, let's let him sit in that Scottish jail for a while. So we didn't do that. But that was interesting to see. Second thing was, I read an article while I was there about the cost of energy for the average person, and that it was just going to swallow up. It was going to swallow up like 3 months of income for people in Scotland just to handle this increase in prices. And so there was somebody from the Scottish Socialist Party somewhere in the city center with a megaphone several days we were there speaking against quote-unquote fuel poverty, which is a legitimate issue, but of course he has no real solution to it. So what I want to know is, obviously this is going to be true not just in Scotland, but throughout the UK. Is there any sign of relief coming there? Or is this really going to be a grim winter? I've already heard about the government trying to help people with fuel payments. What's the status of that?
Well, we have been given bailout money, but you and I both know that's not a solution. It's plastering over the wound. Our fuel policy is so hypocritical. I think we're blessed because it's not going to be that cold a winter, and all the panics that were about a month or so ago about fuel shortages, it looks like we're going to be okay. But we have natural gas in the UK. We have it in the North Sea, and there are bits of land where we could frack and we could be energy self-sufficient. And this was another thing. Truss was going to encourage us to start fracking. And she was going to devolve it so local people could decide if they wanted it or not in their own backyard. And then she lost the thing and Rishi Sunak's come along and he said, no, I'm anti-fracking. And it's because we don't produce our own energy that we're beholden to foreign markets. So we import it from abroad. So rather than produce it ourselves and produce it cleanly, we'll import it, for example, from Russia. Now, are you telling me that Russia seriously produces natural gas in a more environmentally friendly way than we would? And now the nuts thing is, they've now signed a deal. Rishi Sunak's giving it the big one. We signed this deal with Biden. We're going to import loads of liquid natural gas from the US. But how does the US obtain its natural gas? By fracking, which is what you won't have here. So the damage to the environment is still taking place. It's just taking place in another country, out of sight, out of mind. But then you've got all the transport costs and the environmental damage that they do. Plus, we're beholden to the US dollar. Plus, you know, a million other things. And it's just so short-sighted and so hypocritical. You know, and then you've got the anti-nuclear lobby that's blocking any kind of nuclear development, which, you know, as far as electricity at least is concerned, is the silver bullet in all of this. So it's just nuts and it's stupid. And it's when politicians who are scared of being re-elected, who are worried about their appearance, who are worried about their career and all the rest of it, are guiding policy rather than the market, which would sort all of this out in a few months. By the way, you know, to fill up a tank of gas in the UK, in your car, we pay about three or four times as much as you do because of fuel duties, because of taxes on fuel. So we are so misguided in Europe. It's unbelievable. Something like 75% of what you pay in petrol at the tank goes to the government.
I'm telling you, you would be surprised at how often in the US we're told we should be more like Europe and we're so stupid and backward and we're undertaxed here. And they have it better, and they have national health care, and they have this and that, and we're just primitive and backward. It depends on how you define those terms.
Well, your health care policy is a mess, because I think the government spends more per capita on health care in the US.
Oh, it is a total mess.
It doesn't even get... But
total.
The NHS is also awful. Waiting times are longer than ever, waste, corruption, and all the rest of it. And it's worse than it was pre-COVID. Despite billions having been spent on it. It's government getting involved and making a mess.
So tell me a little bit about Rishi Sunak.
Well, he used to attend meetings at the IEA, which is the Institute of Economic Affairs, which would be our equivalent of like the Cato Institute, something like that. So it's a really influential free market think tank set up by an acolyte of Margaret Thatcher back in the day. That would make you optimistic. But he went to public school, which is our word for a private school. He then went to Oxford. He then went to, I think it was Stanford or one of those MBA business school places. Then he went to Goldman Sachs. You know, he's just followed the exact path. You know, that sort of thing that David Icke says, the world is being run by lizards and we just can't see them in plain sight. You know, that whole narrative. Yeah. Well, Rishi Sunak is a lizard, you know.
Okay. He's got all the characteristics.
He's got all the characteristics.
And, oh, gosh.
I mean, he's just a very pragmatic guy. He's married the daughter of the richest man in India. You know, he knows exactly what he's doing. And he's a wise head and he knows which battles he can win and which battles he can't win. But the fact is, he was not the choice of the members of the Conservative Party. And yet, that's what we've ended up with. And they're not going to get rid of him. So he's going to be the Prime Minister until the next election, which will probably be 2 years or so from now. All my conspiracy theorist mates and some of the sensible ones all just say he is a globalist puppet. I've got other mates, you know, who are quite heavily involved in politics and they say he's really good. But in politics, you've got to pick your battles and there's only so many battles you can win and we're in as good a hands as we could be in. But I was away for 3.5 weeks. I went to New Orleans and then to see my mum in California. And then I went down to Ecuador and I went to Galapagos and, you know, you really get off the map in the Galapagos, quite literally. And then I came home and I read the newspaper on the flight home, and I just saw 50 billion quid of raised taxes, you know, all these new ways of fleecing the people, basically to pay for the errors and waste of previous administrations. And you're like, how long does this go on for? Where you spend my money in a way that I don't agree with. And in fact, I told you that if you spent it like that, you would waste it and this and this and this would happen. You went and did it anyway. And now I've got to pay even more money to bail out your mistakes. And that's, I'm afraid, the essence of taxation. But I was just looking at the headlines of all the papers on the flight home last week. And I was thinking, is this really going on in Britain? So we are a big, big mess. And it's, you know, you were bailed out. America was bailed out by the growth in tech in the 90s. And that, you know, went through over the next 20 or 30 years. That's kind of what saved industrial America, the scalability of digital technology. We never really had that. And it's just hard to see where the next growth bubble is going to come from.
Yeah, that was how I think they were able to get away with all the stuff they got away with at the time, that because there was this explosion in wealth made possible by this. And I think that also kept prices down. Lower than they would have been otherwise, because there's a greater abundance of things. But
and it was a whole new frontier.
Yeah.
The internet technology, it was unregulated, so people could progress without government getting in the way. In the physical economy, that's not possible. But tech now, I mean, it'll sort itself out. But yeah. And the thing about tech is it's so scalable. You know, you just invent one widget, you upload it to the App Store, and it can be downloaded a billion times. Whereas if I invent, you know, a fantastic cup or something, I've got to manufacture and distribute a billion of them. So it's just much harder. The physical economy is much harder than the digital one.
Can you explain for a dumb American like me what the process is for somebody to become prime minister? Because for you to say, oh, he wasn't the choice of the Conservative Party, but there he is. I mean, how does this happen exactly? Because here it's very simple. Barring some strange, unexpected event, every 4 years, the country votes for a president. But it sounds like it works differently over there, and I would like to get a clear explanation.
It's not that dissimilar. So let's say that all these videotapes of Hunter Biden emerged, and it was revealed that Joe Biden had concealed them, and there was a deliberate conspiracy to conceal them, and Joe Biden had been part of that, and therefore he was impeached. Who would then become prime minister? Would Kamala Harris automatically become president, or would the Democrats have to elect somebody new?
Oh, Kamala would become president.
Okay. So what happens with us is, because we don't have a deputy prime minister, so to speak, or we did. It's one of those positions that seems to come and go. So when Boris was forced to stand down because of various things he'd done, and again, there's a big argument that this was people who hated Boris just trying to get rid of Boris. When he was forced to step down, the Conservative Party would then have to elect a new leader. So all the MPs, all the members of Parliament would get together, and Joe Smith would go, I want to stand, and Mrs. McKenzie would go, I want to stand. And eventually this would be whittled down to two. And then those two candidates would then campaign to all the members of the Conservative Party, and the Conservative Party would vote for which one they wanted. So that's what happens. So it's instead of Kamala automatically becoming president, if Biden was impeached, there would then be the Democrats would have to decide who the two candidates were, and then those two candidates would be decided on by members of the Democrat Party, and that person would then become president. That's effectively how it works. But the history is that whichever prime minister gets that gig automatically becomes very unpopular because they weren't elected by the democratic mandate of the people. That's what happened to Gordon Brown, for example. He automatically became prime minister after Tony Blair, and the Labour members all voted him in. But then, because he didn't have the mandate of the people, he was very unpopular. And what you should then do is go straight away and hold a general election. But Gordon Brown thought he was going to lose, so he delayed it. So eventually, when the election came, he got wiped out. And Rishi Sunak will now delay holding a general election because he knows he'll lose to Labour. So he'll try and keep the game going as long as possible and try and do something to make himself more popular. So that's how it works, basically. But it's representative democracy. It's crap. It's 200 years out of date. We need a new system.
Well, would you mind giving us, again, for those of us who don't live there, a bit of an overview of the Conservative Party, and you were saying it's very divided. What are the factions like? Is it ideological at all, or is it around personalities, or what?
Well, I mean, basically, the Conservative Party have been in power for 10 years, and everything they've done has been social democrat in policy. You know, they've raised taxes, there's more technocratic involvement, there's more economic intervention. So they're conservative in name only. Really, they're social democrats. And effectively, they're a coalition. Except it's like in some countries, you'll have a coalition that get together after the election and they'll form a coalition and the government will be based on an amalgamation of all those views. Conservative Party is effectively a coalition before it starts. And so all the sort of slightly right of centre people will vote conservative. All the sort of our equivalent of neocons would vote conservative. But also this sort of libertarian-minded, small government, let me get on with my own stuff, low taxation, individual responsibility, all people who have that worldview tend to vote conservative as well. And then left tends to be the social democrats and the socialists. That's the sort of the coalition that makes up the Labour Party. And to be successful in UK politics, effectively, you have to unify your party and you have to unify those two factions within your party and, you know, keep everyone happy. And that's what leads to successful government in the UK. So it just means compromise after compromise after compromise. But that's ideologically, you know, I think something similar happens in the Republican Party in that you've got the sort of Ron Pauls of this world, or maybe I should say the Rand Pauls in the sort of libertarian arm. And then you've got Republicans who are much more keen on higher taxes and more state intervention and all that kind of thing. And, you know, the Republican Party is effectively a coalition.
Well, that's what I was wondering. If it's in some way, if there's an analog there with our Republican Party, but I suspect that our Republican Party is probably 10% better. That was my instinct.
At the moment it is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then also, of course, our Republican Party is very much divided because we have the old guard, which would be the Bush forces and the John McCain forces, people like that, who have, you know, have seen their popularity collapse because of Trump. It would be very, very difficult to imagine like a Mitt Romney successfully running for president again. But on the other hand, we have Trump and DeSantis, where DeSantis isn't saying a word, Trump's just attacking him all day long. And that kind of division, maybe that opens up the possibility for the old guard. But now you have, you know, you have the Trump people and the right-wing populism, but then you also have the people, you know, there are some who are more libertarian, like Congressman Thomas Massey, and somehow they're all held together under this very, very big, strange kind of tent in which they take pot shots at each other sometimes. I mean, does that happen in the Conservative
Party?
Yeah,
it's the same thing. It's the same thing, but done in an English accent.
Okay. Makes it kind of charming.
And yeah, and the Democrats are the same. You've got the sort of Bernie Sanders socialists at one extreme, and then you've got the sort of lightly center, left of center Obama types who, you know, Obama could probably be a soft Republican in another age, couldn't he, almost?
Well, the Obamas of the world are going to repeat all the elite obsessions, you know, in their speeches, and they want the energy of the Bernie types, but then they're happy to just sell them out to Goldman Sachs the first opportunity.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I imagine Obama and Mitt Romney, I don't really know, I'm just blocking out names, but, you know, a moderate Republican and a moderate Democrat are probably closer in policy than a moderate Democrat is to the Bernie Sanders arm of the Democratic Party or the moderate...
And they're friendlier, too. They're friendlier. Romney can't stand the sight of half of his own party, but he would gladly attend a Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama cocktail party. No problem.
Yeah.
So we all face the same lizard people problem. Hey, everybody, I want to recommend a person to you. And that person is Mikkel Thorup, who was my guest on episode 2183. And Mikkel is the host of the Expat Money Show, which is the number one resource for anybody considering the expat lifestyle or offshore investments. Your host, Mikkel Thorup, has been an expat for over 20 years. He's visited over 100 countries and himself lived in 9. And so he has invaluable insight on the expat lifestyle. And that includes how to maximize international investments, how to move offshore for more freedom, privacy, and protection. You're going to gain vital knowledge on wealth protection, tax reduction, investing, migration, citizenship, residency, you name it. You're going to love Mikkel as a person because he's very knowledgeable without being an arrogant jerk. And the variety of topics he covers on the Expat Money Show, where he's telling you about all different countries, all different things you might want to do there, like buying property or getting a job. All this stuff is covered on the Expat Money Show. So go to expatmoney.com today. The link will be in the show notes. That's expatmoney.com, or listen wherever you get your podcasts. I don't want to miss the opportunity to say another brief word about your most recent project, which is, I know, so important to you, and I think very, very, very much worth having for all of the folks who listen to this program. So would you mind, I know you've talked about it a million times, but I have a feeling it's one of those things you don't mind talking about a million times.
I will talk about it until I die.
All right. So I'm talking about Kisses on a Postcard. I hadn't realized until fairly late in our knowing each other, your father's renown as a playwright and, a celebrity in his own right.
Yeah, maybe not a celebrity. I think he was quite big in maybe the 60s. Him and my mum were a sort of glamour couple. But he was a very successful writer. He wrote the longest running comedy in the history of the West End called There's a Girl in My Suit, which had a good run in on Broadway as well. And it was made into a film with Peter Sellers and Goldie Hawn. Quite good film, rom-com, a bit dated now. But so he was a successful playwright. And he wrote this story about his time in World War II when he was evacuated from his family in London, age 7. Along with his brother, who was 11, and they were evacuated from their family in London, along with 4 million other children across the UK. It was the biggest movement of people in our country, and they were all evacuated from the cities down to the countryside. And they didn't know where they were going, how long they'd be going for, who they'd be staying with, nothing. And Dad ended up for 4 years in Cornwall, which is like the remotest part of the UK that there is. It's like being in deepest, darkest Florida or something, only really, really cold and wet. And he spent 4 years down there, and he wrote this musical called Kisses on a Postcard, all about his experiences. And I saw it in 2004, and it wasn't quite the finished article, but I just fell totally in love with it. And Dad died in 2020. And so I spent the lockdown rewriting a lot of the music and putting together, and we put together this 4.5 hour audio version of it. Like a podcast, dreaded word podcast version of this musical. And it's got big stars from Les Mis and all sorts of other musicals in it. It's got a 15-piece orchestra. We recorded it at Abbey Road, where the Beatles recorded all their songs. And it's my kind of masterwork, if you like. And last time I was on the show, we played a couple of songs from it. And I have to tell you, Tom, loads of people emailed me, went to the site, kissesonapostcard.com, and ordered CDs. And so I was having to dispatch hundreds of CDs to America. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Can we play a song from it, maybe? Or
yeah, sure. Tell me, which one would you like us to play and we'll play it?
Well, I can't remember which song we played last time. I think it was a song called Kisses on a Postcard, the title tune.
Yes, I think so too.
So we'll play this song. You have to imagine it's a tiny remote village at the extreme southwest of the UK. And people in the next village were strangers. People from England, even though it wasn't England, people from England were foreigners. And then in the middle of the war, just before D-Day, all the American soldiers came to this village and they were billeted on various villages around the country before D-Day. And the regiment that was billeted on Dad's village was a regiment from Louisiana, and they were all black. And nobody had seen a black man before. And you can imagine just how excited everyone was about that. So this song that I'm going to play you now takes place just after the soldiers have arrived in the village. And it's a great moment in the show. Dad said he had a tap dancing lesson on a sheet of plywood from a man from New Orleans itself. He was terribly excited about that. But anyway, aged 8. And the kids, of course, absolutely love them. But this song occurs shortly after the American soldiers arrive. And the thing that the English kids always used to say to the American soldiers was, "Got any gum, chum?" And that was the great saying at the time. So this song is called "Got Any Gum, Chum."
All right, let's play it.
Hello.
How are you?
good day. We're soldiers from the U.S. of A.
Pleased to meet you, sir.
Pleased to meet you, ma'am.
Pleased to meet you, pretty lady.
We're here for Uncle Sam. At your service this fine day.
Any questions,
please just say.
Questions? Lord!
What's it like in the States? Is it just like the flicks? What's the weather like? Have you flown in a plane? Are there cops and robbers? Are there gangsters too? Are there cowboys and Indians? Do you know John Wayne? Have you ever seen a puma? Have you eaten a satsuma? Do you like hamburgers? Do your cows go moo? Have you crossed the Mississippi? Have you caught a barracuda? Have you been to Colorado or to Kalamazoo? Have you got pubs?
No, we have bars.
Do you catch the bus?
No, we all drive cars.
Have you ever had a pasty?
No, we have not.
Is it true that you eat dogs?
If they're hot.
Have you crossed the Golden Gates? Have you climbed the Empire State? Have you ever smelt a skunk? Why'd you call a tramp a bum?
You have steam trains and you tell me jump.
One last question.
Have you got any gum? Got any gum, chum?
We might have some.
Any gum, chum?
Now don't all scrum.
Any gum, chum?
It sure is yum. You can chew it till your mouth goes numb.
Got any gum, chum?
This sure is fun.
Any gum, chum?
Do the chewing hum.
Yummy, yum, yum.
Rum, pum, pum.
And that is how you do the chewing hum.
We've got snakes and alligators and our own refrigerators. Oranges and peaches, eagles, buffalo. Bears and avocados, a city called Chicago. Frightening tornadoes, tropics, desert and snow. We've got rodeos and ranches, grapes upon the branches. We drink lots of Coca-Cola and there's ice to crush. We've got Mormons, we've got Quakers, we've got towering skyscrapers, but no privies for us. Our lavatories flush.
Do you drink tea?
No sirree.
Speak Cherokee?
Not frequently.
Do you play billiards?
We shoot pool.
Would you like a game of cricket?
We don't understand the rules.
Do you know Clark Gable? Is Harper really dumb? Have you ever had a Hershey? Have you hit a home run? Please give me an answer. Can you tell me, chum? One last question. Have you got any gum? Got any gum, chum?
We might have some.
Any gum, chum?
Now don't all scrum.
Any gum, chum?
It sure is yum. You can chew it till your mouth goes numb.
Got any gum, chum?
It sure is fun.
Any gum, chum?
Do the chewing hum.
Yummy, yum, yum.
Rum, pum, pum.
And that is how you do the chewing hum.
Well, I just love this. I love the idea behind it. I love that it was a passion project of yours. I love that you're bringing to life something your father wrote, even after he's gone. And if you're interested not only in history, but frankly, in the human condition, I think it's going to be a real treat for you. It's extremely well done. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Very, very moving. And, you know, in a way, it reminds me of something during COVID that a lot of times people who were advocating the various restrictions, particularly ones on children, would say, well, don't worry about it. Children are resilient. And I got tired of hearing children are resilient. Maybe they are. I just don't want them to have to be, you know? But this goes to show, gosh, I guess they are resilient if they endured this successfully.
Well, they're incredibly resilient. And, you know, some of the kids had happy experiences. A lot of them didn't. But can you imagine just being 7 years old, just taken away from your parents and shoved into the middle of nowhere?
I can't imagine it now. I can't imagine being separated from anybody now.
And what it did, it just destroyed families across the country. And some kids never saw their parents again. You know, other kids were interfered with. You know, other kids were bullied. Some of the kids had horrible experiences. My dad called it his second childhood. And thankfully, he had a very happy experience. But he always reported it like that. And he was very positive. But if he was of a more negative mindset, you know, he might have seen it in a very different light. It destroyed the parents, it destroyed the kids, and it had a huge impact on the communities that they went to, because suddenly all these communities had a load of new kids to look after. And the local kids were like, well, what about us? You know, so I think it had an incredibly damaging effect on families across the country, broadly speaking. But I'll tell you, I played the first 20 minutes, half an hour. I was skiing with a bunch of friends earlier in the year, and we had to drive from the ski resort back to the airport. And so there were five of them in the car. So I just played the first half hour, you know, to everyone in the car. And it was just as all the evacuees were escaping the Russian invaders. And everyone said, this is just what's going on in Ukraine now. So the story is timeless. And yeah, I mean, nobody factors in, you know, governments go to war with each other. And then afterwards, they have all these memorials to remember the fallen and all the rest of it. And it was like, you started that war. And, you know, you just look at history. People say religion is the greatest cause of war in history. It isn't. It's government. And, you know, every time I think about governments going to war because of stupid politicians and all the rest of it, it just makes me angry.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. So I suppose, well, first of all, let me just note, I would be willing to guess that most Americans don't even know this happened. I don't think any, when I used to be a professor, I don't think any of my students even know that this occurred. I mean, this is a massive, socially revolutionary act that was done. And there isn't even a trace of it in the historical memory of almost everyone in, certainly in the US. I'm sure it's quite different over there. But, you know, on the other hand, people would say, but it was for their safety. I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, they were being bombed otherwise.
Exactly. And how many of them would have died if they'd stayed? And, you know, these are the impossible decisions, I guess, that policymakers have to make in times of war. And I guess they go safety first. And I guess preserving their life was considered more important than the destruction of the family. And it is taught a little bit in the schools. But most people's grandparents, most, I'm in my 50s, and most people with parents in their late 80s or 90s, you know, that was the generation, people who'd be in their 90s now, that was the generation that was evacuated. And, you know, most people will have a parent or a grandparent who it happened to, and they will tell the story. But it's just preserved, the story's more preserved in, you know, there's been a couple of films about it, a couple of books. You know, this would make a wonderful Netflix series, for example. There have been a couple of things about it, but it's more in the minds of British people than something that's like, you know, everyone knows about the coronation of Queen Elizabeth in 1952 or about Charles and Diana or whatever it is. It's not embedded like that is embedded. And it's a shame because it's a huge, huge story which had a huge effect on the psyche of the country.
Give us the website for it.
KissesOnAPostcard.com.
Couldn't be easier.
KissesOnAPostcard.com. And you can listen to it as a podcast, Apple Podcasts or whatever, or you can order a CD and I'll send you a CD. The podcast is free. I'm afraid you got to pay for the CD.
All right. Excellent. Excellent. Well, wonderful. Well, Dom, thanks so much. I do want to urge people to do that. I'll also have the link up at tomwoods.com/2237. My plan is to be in London with at least one of my daughters. Depends on how many of them I can talk into it. I don't know. Maybe they won't have to be talked into it. Maybe they'll love the idea. I haven't raised it with them yet, but sometime this July. So if that happens and you're not in the Galapagos or something, it'd be nice to see you.
I'd love to see you, my man. And July's, what, nine months away, 8 months away?
It's a long ways away.
We've got a lot of prep time.
Yeah, we do indeed. Thanks again.
All right. Cheers, Tom.
All right. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And don't forget to check out Larry Lepard's presentation on how to protect yourself against inflation. They are screwing you, but there are ways to fight back. So check it out at tomwoods.com/Larry, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.